And to put it in context, there are about 20 different endorphins in the brain. The most common one, and the one that's really strongly linked to, say, runner's high, has been shown to be 100 times more powerful than medical morphine.
The Triathlon Show, episode 82. Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, we discuss flow with Stephen Kotler. Stephen is a world-leading expert on the topic of flow. We'll discuss what flow really is and how it works, how it helps athletes and triathletes perform better in races and get more out of training by, among other things, accelerating learning, reducing pain, and increasing muscle strength, the flow triggers that can give rise to flow, and some special tricks that you can use to give it that little extra nudge and push you over the edge to the state of heightened consciousness to feel your best and perform your best. Things that may prevent you from entering a flow state, and how long you can expect a flow state to last, and how frequently you can have it. But first, a word from our sponsor, Precision Hydration. They make electrolyte products that you can tailor to your individual electrolyte loss rate to improve performance and reduce risk of cramps. And if you remember back to episode 40, which is one of my favorite episodes of all time on That Triathlon Show with Jesse Kropelnicki, he stated that it's a sin when some athletes that train a heck of a lot for their goal race take time away from their family, but then make easily avoidable mistakes with nutrition and hydration. And Precision Hydration offers both the knowledge and the products you need to avoid such mistakes when it comes to hydration. And you can gain that knowledge by taking their free online sweat test on precisionhydration.com to get your personalized sweat profile. And you can then tailor that with their superior quality, very affordable products to not need to worry about messing up your hydration ever again. And if you end up buying any of their products, use the discount code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, for 15% off. So that's a nice little discount there. Now, a quick introduction to Stephen. He's a speaker, a world-leading expert on ultimate human performance, and director of research at the Flow Genome Project. And he's also a New York Times best-selling author. His book, Rise of Superman, is the first book ever to have been a national number one bestseller in the sports, science, and business categories at the same time. And this interview is, I just did it as I record this intro. It's one of the favorite interviews I've done, so I'm very excited to let you hear about it. Let's just jump right in. Today on That Triathlon Show, I have Stephen Kotler, best-selling author and researcher in flow, among other things. But today's topic is about that specifically. So, Stephen, welcome to That Triathlon Show.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. We were just chatting off air, and I'm very interested in the topic of flow myself and all sorts of things related to human performance. And that's what you really specialize in, optimal human performance. And that's what you write that flow is. It's a state of optimal consciousness. Can you just give us a brief overview of a bit more about what flow really is? And let's define it for the audience.
For sure. It's a good place to start. So technically, flow is defined as an optimal state of consciousness, a state where we feel our best and we perform our best. And there's tons of synonyms, right? You could call it runner's high or being in the zone or being unconscious or the forever box. Flow is a technical term. I can get to why in a second, but it really describes those moments of rapt attention and total absorption. We get so focused on the task at hand that everything else just simply disappears. So action awareness will start to merge. Your sense of self will vanish. Time passes strangely. It slows down occasionally. More often it speeds up. And throughout all aspects of performance, both mental and physical, go through the roof.
And not to get too wrapped up in the background, the science and the mechanisms behind it, but there are some pretty deep neuroscience behind this. So can you just quickly cover that as well?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, when you're talking about the brain, if you want to be accurate, you're really talking about three things. You're talking about neuroanatomy, where in the brain something is taking place, neurochemistry and neuroelectricity, which are literally just the two ways the brain sends signals back and forth. It's how the brain talks to itself and to the body, right? So what we see in flow is a marked shift from kind of normal waking consciousness. So normal waking consciousness, where we are right now, right? You've got a lot of activity in your prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that's right behind your forehead, where we govern higher cognitive functions, your sense of morality, your sense of will, complex decision-making, long-term planning, right? So that's really active right now, you know, just in waking consciousness. Your brain waves are in beta, which is a fast-moving wave where you are kind of when you're, you know, awake and alert and paying attention. 21st century normal, unfortunately, from a neurochemical standpoint, is really our stress chemicals. It's like a steady drip, drip, drip of norepinephrine, which is essentially the chemical under anxiety and fear, and cortisol, which is another stress hormone, right? So in flow, all three things shift. What happens is we get a marked decrease in activity in the prefrontal cortex. That shuts down. And that shutdown explains a lot of flow's really weird stuff. Like, why does time pass so strangely in flow? Turns out time's calculated all over the prefrontal cortex, and if parts of it wink out, we can't separate past and present from future. So we're plunged into what researchers call the deep now, or the eternal present. We also, brain waves, instead of being up at the fast-moving wave of beta, they drift down kind of the borderline between alpha waves and theta waves. Alpha waves are daydreaming mode. It's right where the brain is sort of moving from idea to idea without a lot of resistance. And theta is kind of the way brainwave we get in REM sleep or hypnagogic state as you're falling asleep, which is like when the green sweater you're thinking about suddenly becomes a green elephant, suddenly becomes a green lawn, something blah, blah, blah. That's the brainwave change that we get. And neurochemically, the stress hormones flush out of your system and they're replaced by five of the most potent kind of feel-good performance-enhancing drugs the brain can produce. So that's kind of the neurobiological signature. There's a bunch of physiological correlates for flow that we're starting to just now get a peek at as well. But those are the brain stuff we're pretty confident about.
Yeah, that's cool. And one thing that I immediately started thinking about is when you said that the prefrontal cortex is suppressed. I mean, that's the prefrontal cortex is known to be like the modern part of the brain, the thinking part of the brain. And when I experience flow, when I in triathlon, for example, or in action sports or adventure sports, that's where I usually experience it. It's as if you mentioned it, kind of alluded to it, that it's more of a conscious state, but to me it feels like I'm not really thinking. So that suppression of the prefrontal cortex kind of explains that very well.
Yeah, and in slightly different terms, right? So what you're doing in flow is you're trading conscious processing, which, as you pointed out, really powerful. Very, very powerful, but it's an energy hog. It's very energy inefficient, uses a lot of calories, and it's very slow. Conscious thought moves about 150 miles an hour, though measuring it has been tricky. The adaptive unconscious, to use kind of the technical term, what we call the subconscious these days, is very, very energy efficient. It's very, very, very quick. So thought has been measured in the adaptive unconscious up to 100,000 miles an hour. So you're absolutely right. So when we're in flow, one of the crazy things that happens is, in a sense, you get to actually, it's the only time you actually get to watch the adaptive unconscious work, right? Which is often why, like, it's such a weird state, because the adaptive unconscious moves so differently from normal waking state consciousness.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's a very good clarification. So yeah, brilliant. And so for athletes, for triathletes, for example, or any athlete really, I've read that somewhere on your website, I believe that in one of your videos it was that you said that there's a state of flow behind every world championship or Olympic medal or whatever it is. So can you go a bit deeper into how athletes tap into flow and use it to perform their best in their athletic achievements?
So So it's, you don't, you can, there are cases of like world championships, gold medals, that sort of thing. You can win out of flow. You really, you can do it. It is incredibly unpleasant, painful, difficult, and it's not sustainable over the long haul at all. So, but you can do it. But it not frequently, not often. Most of the other time we see people in flow. And the reason is from a physiological standpoint. So let's just talk about some of the things we know. The neurochemicals that show up in flow, for example, dopamine, norepinephrine, these do everything from kind of speed up muscle reaction times. We get more strength in flow. There's like a 15% boost in strength that was recorded kind of at the University of Pennsylvania when they looked at this. That may not be across the boards, right? It may vary from athlete to athlete, but that was a huge boost, and it deadens a lot of pain. So both endorphins and anandamide, which are two of the other chemicals that show up in flow, are huge painkillers, right? So, and to just put it in context, so endorphins, that's the body's own internal opiate, right? So it, the exogenous, if you wanted to take it pharmacologically, you'd be taking opiates like morphine or hydrocodone or, you know, that sort of stuff. And to put it in context, there are about 20 different endorphins in the brain. The most common one, and the one that's really strongly linked to, say, runner's high, has been shown to be 100 times more powerful than medical morphine. So huge amount of kind of pain relief in the state too. To say nothing of the fact that, you know, if your decision making, you know, cognitive function goes through the roof, motivation goes through the roof, creativity goes through the roof, learning, all those things are peaked. And, you know, we can talk about why if you want, but it just amps. Flow is how it is the biological state for high performance. We're all built for it. The state is ubiquitous. It shows up in anyone, anywhere, provided certain initial conditions are met. And that's the second half of your question, right? Which was, how do athletes get into the flow? So the answer is, we now know that flow states have triggers, preconditions that lead to more flow. And there are about 20 in total. And, you know, 10 of them produce individual flow, what you would, the state you would get into by yourself out running or cycling. Or the group flow, which is what happens when a whole team comes together and you see a group performing at their peak. Or so what you get in either like a great brainstorming session, or if you've ever sung in a church choir, played in a band, or, you know, watch a fourth quarter comeback in football. That's all examples of group flow. And so,
can you also experience group flow when you're in a race and you have your competitors around you, even though you're not a team per se, and you're
so there's actually. There seems to be, and this was, the research was done at Cal State Fullerton. I want to say it was Kendra Visa. I can't remember who did the original work, but there are sort of like, they think about it this way. There's, you know, solitary flow that, you know, you running alone, or there's sort of like singular flow in a group, like what a surfer or an athlete might get running with a pack, or a surfer, you know, you're everybody's surfing individually, but you're all hanging out waiting for the waves and you're sort of competing for the waves, but mostly you're competing against yourself, right? And then there's, you know, full on football, basketball, baseball, group stuff.
Right. Yeah. Got it. So go on. Did you have anything else to add to those flow triggers and to
the thing you need to know, the most obvious, is that flow follows focus, right? It only shows up when all of our attention is in the right here, the right now. So that's what all the triggers do. They drive attention into the present moment. For example, risk is a flow trigger, right? So, you know, for your listeners, what you might feel at the, you know, at the start of a gnarly triathlon, something that's scary, that's heavy, right? It's going to focus you. It's going to drive attention to now. Now, interestingly, this work hasn't actually been done. It comes out of there's a lot of work on flow and sex. And that's some of the stuff we talk about in my new book, Stealing Fire. But there's interesting research out of the BDSM community that talks about masochists getting a very extreme flow state. They call it flying. And it's triggered by pain. And nobody's really looked at this enough to talk about why, but this is definitely what we're seeing with a lot of endurance athletes. And the reason is really simple. Pain, and especially extreme pain, what you're feeling towards the end of a race, as you know, it's all consuming. It takes all of your attention. It focuses all your attention on that thing, right? That's what extreme pain is. you want to move like one step up the scale away from extreme pain, you're in the fight or flight response, right? Where there are three options instead of one. You can fight, you can freeze, you can flee, right? So choices get wider and wider as you move up that scale, but extreme pain really focuses the attention on the right here, right now. So I think when you're looking at endurance athletes, some of it's risk, some of it is novelty, complexity, unpredictability. Those are all flow triggers. Those are all things that, you know, show up, you know, for certainly if you're doing any off-road running, riding, open ocean stuff, right? The ocean is filled with constant unpredictability and novelty and complexity. So all those things are also triggering flow in the context for triathletes. Let me actually make this practical in a sense. So when I work with runners, for example, who are really trying to spend more time in flow, one of the first things I do is I get them off the pavement and into the woods and get them trail running and making new trails as they run, because you're massively increasing novelty, complexity, and unpredictability. So you're going to just get way more flow. And if you really want to kind of turn it up a notch, run downhill, right? Run some long uphill and then run downhill through the woods at higher speeds where your feet start moving faster than your body, kind of thing. Absolutely a phenomenal flow trigger. I use it. I use that very method almost every day to put myself into flow, and my dogs actually.
Yeah, I recognize that definitely. Running downhill and running off road, that's brilliant. But also, as you say, the focus. And so even on a like regular boring triathlon course that's pretty flat and you're pretty safe, you can have that when you're really in the zone and you're really focused. But I guess that's what we really want to.
That's what competition does, right? I mean, that's why competition is so good for so many people. It's a focusing mechanism, right? We're competitive by design on a certain level. So it just, you know, and especially if you're wired that way, if you're a competitive athlete, you love competition because it's a focusing mechanism.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's get into this one. This is a good one, I think. How long can a flow state last? Because let's say you're doing an Ironman and you're going to be out there for everything from 8 to 16 hours, depending on your ability. So can you be in flow for the entire race, or how does that work?
So the answer is a mystery, in all honesty, because what we know about flow on average is the state lasts an hour and a half. And we know that because the neurochemicals that really underpin the state, some of them are really short-lived in the brain, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, that sort of thing at their peak state. So that's what, you know, we know. Unfortunately, what we find is that, yeah, all the time, runners, you know, triathletes will go out there. Doesn't happen very often where you're in a flow state for the entire race. And usually I found with endurance athletes, it takes a while. Right, you have to get to some level of exhaustion before you can start reaching flow, because flow shows up when we're pushing ourselves. We're using another one of flow's triggers is known as the challenge skills balance. So when the challenge of the task at hand slightly exceeds your skill set, right, you want to stretch but not snap. That really drives attention. It's, you know, it's the Erks-Dobson curve more formally. But with endurance athletes, you don't see that right off the bat. It does happen, but you usually don't see it right off the bat. But yeah, there are, and you know, I had an experience where I spent 2 weeks in a nonstop flow state and I wrote half of a book in that state. So I've had it, you know, in as an athlete and outside of an athlete, but on average, it's about an hour and a half.
Okay. And that, what you just mentioned about the challenge skill trigger, that brings about another question. What are the ways that we can, okay, so we talked about racing and focus, but is there anything that we can do in addition to having those components in place already to kind of push ourselves into flow and kind of be the final trigger to make us easier get into flow state? Because at least personally, I know that not every race is a race where I enter some sort of zone or flow state. So, but if we could do that, it would be so much better. We would perform so much better.
So some of what I'm about to tell you is stuff we suspect is true after having thousands and thousands of conversations about this stuff. There's a lot of work left on this stuff, but it does seem true that, you know, the obvious stuff is really important. So when we, for example, we did a a joint learning exercise with Google 3 years ago. And we trained them up in the use of 4 flow triggers. And we trained them up in 4 high performance basics. Get enough sleep. Cannot emphasize, get enough sleep, drink enough water. You know, things along those lines are really important because it's a high energy state, right? Which is not to say that you can't get into flow when tired, but here's what's interesting. When you have too much norepinephrine in your system, and norepinephrine is anxiety, you get out of that sweet spot between the challenge and skills balance, and it tends to block your ability to get into flow. So whenever we're tired, right, your brain is always performing a calculation. It's saying you're tired, you don't have enough energy for this current situation, you can't meet potential threats, and you feel more fear in every situation. So it's got to be tuned very correctly. The only other trigger that you might want to, I mean, there's, I've done a ton of work on the flow triggers. You can read Rise of Superman for a breakdown. You can read Bold for a breakdown. You can find millions of videos on StephenKotler.com or on the FlowGenomeProject.com that go deeper into this stuff. But the next trigger that I think is really important and tricky to use in a race, because it's going to cost you a little bit, but maybe effective. So creativity, which is what I really mean by that, is pattern recognition. When two ideas come together, we get a little squirt of dopamine. One of the chemicals that's underneath flow, it's a profound focusing chemical. It does a bunch of other stuff. But so you've done a crossword puzzle. You get an answer right? You link two ideas together and you get that little squirt of feel-good dopamine. That's feel-good drug. That's dopamine. So for example, when I'm out running and I do this a lot while skiing, you can apply it however you want, or downhill mountain biking, I start creatively interpreting the terrain. So if I want to ski something really challenging, right, I don't immediately go to the super challenging thing and try to use risk as a flow trigger to drive me in, because it's too dangerous. If it doesn't work, I could end up in the hospital. If I'm going to do something dangerous and dumb and stupid and risky, I want to be in flow. I want to know I'm in flow before I've attempted it, right? I don't want to use the thing to get me into flow. So what I'll do instead is I'll do a warm-up lap where I will creatively interpret every inch of the terrain that I can. So if there's a little roller that I normally jump left off of, I'm going to jump right. If there's a wall that I can jump up on and ride, and normally, you know, all that kind of stuff. So when I'm out trail running and I want to start doing that, I just interpret the terrain. Oh, there's a boulder. I'm going to see if I could jump off of it and spin 360 degrees in the air and keep running, right? I add in, I call it hillbilly parkour. It's not pretty, but the creativity, the interpretation of the terrain, if you start stacking creative act on top of creative act on top of creative act, you're going to drive dopamine into the system. And you do enough of it, you're going to start matching the dopamine count you get from taking a big risk. So you'll start, you know, it's an easy way to get put into flow. It's a slightly harder thing to do in a race, for sure. But for training runs, it's really good.
Yeah. That's super interesting. And yeah, I wanted to ask that about training as well, because you mentioned that that it accelerates learning. So I was thinking that can flow be in a training situation, not necessarily racing, used to enhance the adaptations that we can get from training, not necessarily physically, but sort of
everything
mentally? Or
quick shorthand for how learning and memory work in the brain: more neurochemicals that show up during experience, better chance it's going to move from short-term holding into long-term storage. Flow is this huge dump of 5 really potent neurochemicals. So in studies run by the Department of Defense with both snipers and radar operators, actually, they saw learning spike 470% while in flow, which is a huge spike. It's enormous, which is why, you know, people are working really hard on flow and education stuff right now, everywhere from, you know, in the classroom to in virtual reality education efforts. We're seeing a lot of stuff because learning is so amplified in flow.
What about the difference between elite athletes in any sport, really, and the normal everyday triathletes or skiers, surfers? Is there a difference there? Are the elite athletes elite because they can more easily get into flow? And is that something they consciously practice? Or is it something that everybody can learn? And we're not just not doing it as much for the normal age groupers?
So there's a couple different answers here. The elite athletes, yes, the answer is they're getting more flow. And I'll talk about why in half a second, and I'll talk about what we see difference-wise. But flow is a spectrum. You can have micro flow, which is like, so flow has seven core characteristics. I listed a bunch before: the merger of action, awareness, the vanishing of self, time dilation, etc. Micro flow is when a couple of them show up at once, right? So that's when, you know, you go out for a leisurely run and you sort of forget time passes very, very quickly, and you forget that your body's in pain and you have to go to the bathroom and you come back an hour later, and right, that's a micro flow state. Macro flow is when all the characteristics show up at once, and it honestly just feels like a full-blown mystical experience, right? We thought these states were mystical experiences until the 1950s. For the first 70 years, researchers were looking at them. They didn't think they were mystical in that they were otherworldly, but they thought they only showed up in spiritual and religious people during rituals and things like that. It was only after Abraham Maslow discovered flow in a huge study group filled with atheists that anybody kind of changed their opinion on that one.
Interesting, yeah. So are there any other tips that we can... So, okay, no, let me ask you this. How often can we expect to learn to get into flow if we start to practice some of these things and go and watch your videos and buy your book and start to really try to get into flow? Is that something that you can expect to happen almost every training session even, or is it something that you can't expect?
No, you can't. And there's no way... So here's what we know. What we know is, and we know this from, for example, we did that training at Google. We worked with them for 6 weeks. They did about an hour of homework a day, spread out throughout the day, but it was an hour altogether. And we trained them up in four flow triggers and four high performance basics. And what we saw in, and it was 80 different Googlers, and they were from all over the company. So every department you can imagine, we saw a 35 to 80% increase in flow. Now, that's pretty good. We have a digitally delivered course on the Flow Genome Project website called Flow Fundamentals. We do pre and post measurement, and we measure, you know, seven characteristics of flow. And on average, we're seeing a 70% boost in flow. So this tells us two things. First of all, don't get super excited. These are all people who self-selected for a deep interest in this stuff. So their numbers are probably a little higher than what the average person can expect. That said, what this really tells us is that this stuff is really trainable. It's not that our kung fu is so good. I think it's really good, but there are a lot of other people doing this work out there who are just as good. But this stuff is really, really trainable. It's really funny because when you start working with the triggers, novelty, complexity, unpredictability, these don't sound like much, right? They're really simple ideas. Oh, all these things drive focus into the present moment. But really simple ideas, you know, well deployed, are producing spectacular results.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us a little bit more about the Flow Genome Project, because that's something that's really interesting, what you have got going on there with Jamie, your co-founder. Can you tell us more about that?
So we're a research and training organization. On the training side, we work with everybody from like the U.S. Special Forces and professional athletes through corporations like Google and Ameritrade to the general public. And on the research side, we are the largest or one of the largest open source research projects into ultimate human performance in the world. We are always kind of running a handful of studies. Right now, there's a flow and creativity study we're doing. Next week, we launch the very first ever comparative study between flow and psychedelics, which is a comparative altered states, which is something that's really exciting. And people have been talking about for 25 years. And finally, the technology has gotten to the point that we can actually start asking some of these questions. So we're helping to launch with guys at Imperial College in London, the first ever flow and psychedelic study. So just, you know, training, research.
Cool. Yeah. And you have got plenty of good videos, really good videos on there, high quality stuff that I really recommend listeners go and have a look at. I'll link to the site, and there you can find the videos in the show notes. And what about your book, The Rise of Superman, that is all about flow and decoding the science of optimal human performance?
So I've written eight books. Five of them are about flow. West to Jesus, my second book, is sort of about the neuroscience of mystical experience and how flow relates to that. My third book is A Small Furry Prayer, and that is sort of the evolution of flow is covered in there, and its kind of relationship to kind of questions around animals and mysticism and empathy and things like that. In Rise of Superman, that I looked at how action-adventure sport athletes are harnessing flow to extend the upper limits of physical performance. In Bold, one of the things we do in that book is explore how this is showing up in business. And in Stealing Fire, we extend it from just flow to kind of all altered states that impact performance, and kind of give you a look at everything that's going on in the space and the kind of the huge revolution that's taking place in that space right now.
Yeah, and as we talked about before the interview, triathletes are on average pretty high performance in life and in business in general. So I'm sure that a lot of your books will be of great interest for them, not just from a triathlon perspective, but otherwise as well. So go and have a look at Stephen's website if you're interested in that and want a new book for Christmas or something like that. One question that I forgot to ask that I want to get into before the rapid fire questions is what kind of science and research is out there on flow in endurance athletes, and if none, what do you have any anecdotal evidence about how it works and or how important it is, I should say, from just what you've found with working with athletes, endurance athletes specifically?
I mean, so endurance athletics has been deeply embedded in this research for a while for no other reason than Arne Dietrich, who is one of the principal researchers. He's the first person who figured out that the prefrontal cortex deactivates in flow. He did it when he was at Georgia Tech, and I believe he was running Ironmans while he was doing it. He's definitely a triathlete, and I think he was competing in the Ironman at the time. And so that was definitely, you know, there from the beginning. We know there's research on, so when the prefrontal cortex deactivates, it's called transient, meaning temporary, hypofrontality. Hypo, H-Y-P-O, it's the opposite of hyper. It means to slow down, to deactivate, to shut down. And frontality is the prefrontal cortex, so that we know there's something called exercise-induced transient hypofrontality, which is essentially runner's high. And a lot of people have looked at it to the point that, like at the University of Arizona, just to see, they trained a human, a dog, and a ferret to run on a treadmill. And then afterwards, they looked for anandamide, which is one of the chemicals that underpins flow. Same psychoactive chemical that's in marijuana, actually. And it provides a lot of pain relief and improves lateral thinking and some other stuff. They found it in the humans and the dogs. Two species that evolved to run long distances, not in the ferrets. And in fact, we think initially the first emergence of flow was that it emerged from distance running, right? We're the only species that evolved to run down their prey using kind of endurance and exhaustion as our strategy. So any creature who got a little bit more endorphins or anandamide, a painkiller along the way, is going to be a more successful runner, hunter, get more meat, feed their kids, have more kids, et cetera, et cetera. So in the beginning, we don't think that was the accelerant that really drove flow wide in the population. I think that was something else. But we think originally that it emerged out of distance running. So there's a term, I mean, so not only do we have, you know, research on endurance athletes contemporary, the evolution of flow goes all the way back. Like what we know about it goes all the way back to endurance sport.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. Is there anything out there on the performance side of things, like how much performance can improve because of flow? You mentioned the strength percentage improvements. Is there anything for endurance?
Yeah, so most of the numbers that we most, oddly, so much. And so the best book on this subject is by a woman named Susan Jackson, and it's called Flow in Sports. And Susan's awesome. She worked with Mihai Csikszentmihalyi at the University of Chicago. He's often considered the godfather of flow psychology. There's a lot of data in there to take a look at. We've got better metrics for cognitive function right now, for what flow does for cognitive function. Like we know it boosts creativity 400 to 700%. Productivity goes up 500%. So we've got good cognitive metrics. We don't have, it's, you know, muscle reaction time, for example, is a really tricky thing to measure, if for no other reason than tall people and short people have, like, you know, the signal has to travel through the body. So there's a delay in measuring taller people than in shorter people, right? Because the information literally has to travel farther. So, like, it gets tricky. There's a lot of people who've been poking at it, but I haven't seen anything that I love yet.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. And I think that we've seen that there's a lot of things that we as endurance athletes can gain from trying to use this state of heightened consciousness and optimal performance, feel good and perform well in races. And we have some action tips, like really focusing on the now and perhaps using the power of the group, even in that individual setting, and getting enough sleep and some other things. So this has been really, really useful, Stephen. I just have 3 rapid-fire questions for you before we end this interview. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource that anything really that the listeners of this show may find interesting?
Well, book, blog, I'm going to go with a book, and there's a great book that was written by a guy named Rob Schultes back in the 90s. He was sort of one of the only guys poking at this stuff before I was. And he wrote a book called Bone Games, Zen Shamanism, The Search for Transcendence. And he takes a long, deep look at endurance sport there, across the boards, whether it's, you know, mountaineering, which is a different kind of endurance sports, into running and whatnot. So that might be interesting. And if you're super interested in the consciousness stuff, calling this book an introduction is wrong, because it's not an introductory book at all, but it is my favorite book on consciousness, and it's called The User Illusion by Torni Anderson. And it's just fantastic.
Okay, we'll have those linked up, and that's really good recommendations. The first times we've heard them as recommendations, so that's always good to have some new books. And the next question is, when do you get into your best flow state?
I get into the most flow while riding or hurling myself down mountains at high speeds. So I ski, I downhill mountain bike, I like surfing. Rock climbing can be fun, but, you know, I also, like, I'm a gym rat. I love lifting weights. There's flow to be had there. I do a lot of public speaking. There's a lot of flow to be had on stage. And the truth of the matter is my whole life is designed to produce flow. So if I'm not finding my way, at least to a bunch of micro flow states a day, I'm doing something wrong.
Do you go backcountry skiing? And if so, what are your favorite places to do that?
I'm much more a front country skier than a backcountry guy. I do, you know, occasionally go backcountry. And usually if I'm going backcountry, it's with my friends up in Whistler.
Yeah.
Or my friends in Tahoe. Okay. So Tahoe and, you know, British Columbia would be my favorite spots, I guess, for backcountry stuff. But the truth of the matter, like, I ski 50 days a year, and they're my favorite days, and I want to spend them going downhill as fast as possible. So I don't have an entire day to waste to climb up.
Yeah.
I'd rather ski crap conditions at high speeds than waste an entire day climbing up to get one mile.
Fair enough.
Like, I just don't get it. I like to go down. Yeah. Gravity is my favorite drug.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the risk and the speed, that the risk that comes with the speed, I can imagine, is a much better trigger for flow than going up, which is...
Also, one last thing, by the way, just another trigger for your readers. I recommended trail running. So it's not just the speed, it's also frame rate. So when objects are where there's objects that are close by your eyes and they're moving by quickly, so single track mountain biking kind of thing, riding a bike through traffic gives you the same kind of, right? That also focuses attention a lot, and there's evolutionary reasons, but speed is my friend.
Finally, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Oh, I get up. I start every day at 3:45 in the morning.
And ooh, that's no early.
I get 4 hours of work done before most people are even awake.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's impressive. That's very impressive. I'm a 5:15 guy myself. All right, Stephen, this has been really, really great and interesting. And I highly recommend all the listeners go and check you out on stephenkotler.com and on the Flow, not deep, but www.flowgenomeproject.com. And check out all the videos and the resources and see if any of the books pick their fancy. So that will be really, really good for anybody who's interested in this kind of stuff. I've looked at a ton of the videos. I spent way too much time researching this episode because I just got stuck in the rabbit hole of looking at Flow videos with you and the other people from the Flow Genome Project. But anyway.
Let me drop one more thing on you since you like the videos so much.
Absolutely.
Starting 2 weeks ago, I started it, but every Monday at 3 o'clock Mountain Time, so 2 o'clock Pacific and 5 o'clock Eastern, I do Monday of the Mind on the Flow Genome Project Facebook page. I do a half hour Facebook Live where we take one very specific flow hacking detail and drill down into it for a half an hour.
Perfect. We'll link that up in the show notes as well. All right. Thank you so much, Stephen, for taking the time to talk to me and to the listeners. It's been really, really fascinating. I really, really appreciate you taking the time. So thanks again.
My pleasure.
So my hope is that you not just listen to this episode and think, hey, that's cool, but actually start to apply these different ways that we talked about to try to reach a flow state, both in training and racing. Do go and check out all those videos on flowgenomeproject.com. Honestly, I wasted a whole morning there when I had allocated an hour and a half to research, and then it ended up being 4 hours and a half just watching those videos. But hey, they were good and I got a lot out of it. So I wouldn't call it wasting time. I would call it time well spent. So go and do that when you have the time. And go check out the Flow Genome Project Facebook page for that Monday of the Mind live video that Stephen talked about. Highly recommended related listening for this episode is episode 17 of that Triathlon Show. It's called Brain Training and Psychobiology of Endurance Performance with Professor Samuele Marcora. And these topics are super related because in that episode, Samuele talked about how our physiology doesn't limit perception of effort. Physiology doesn't limit performance, but perception of effort does. And in slightly different terms to what Stephen used, that's exactly what happens when you get into a state of flow. You can reduce your perception of effort, among other things, just because of that pain relief that you, or reduced pain that you can feel when you get those chemicals flooding your brain. So I must say, from a personal experience, I have experienced flow in multiple races. And that's always, invariably, when I perform best. But then the quest for me now, especially after this interview, has become to really try and learn how I can almost guarantee that I can get into a flow state on race day. And I think that the creativity trick with the environment Stephen talked about is a good way to do it. And I'll definitely try this. What I'll try to do is to imagine myself being on a single track trail, whether it's on the bike or on the run, in a fast changing environment with different stimuli for visually and sensory as well, even though I'm maybe out on a boring, straight, flat road, and add those layers of creativity on that to get into the flow state. And one thing is for sure, this is not something that you can just wing it in racing and it will happen. You need to practice this in training and practice it in tune-up races and all those sorts of things. So that's what I'll do. And those are a few of my main takeaways from this episode. And now I want to hear your thoughts and takeaways on it. And the way I want to hear them is I recently updated my website a little bit on scientifictriathlon.com. And in that process, I updated the commenting system on the show notes page. And what I want to do going forward for every single episode is to become really super active there with all the comments. I'll go in and check the comments daily. And let's bring the discussion forward and have a discussion together on those show notes pages for all episodes, and for this one in particular. So go to thattriathlonshow.com and click through to the show notes for this episode, or go directly to scientifictriathlon.com/TTS82. That's as in That Triathlon Show 82. And I hope I'll have the show notes ready when you type that in. I usually get them done pretty close to the time at which the podcast is released. So yeah, go there, write your topics, your thoughts on the topic, not your topics on the thought. And do you experience flow in training or racing? That's a good place to start a discussion. And have you found any patterns in when it happens, if you have experienced it? And how will you apply what you just learned from this episode going forward? So let's discuss these things in those comments. I really, really look forward to interacting with you there. And of course, that show notes page is anyway where you can get a refresher of all the details from the interview. And on the next episode, I want to give you a little teaser. That's an interview with Mark Elliott. He is Triathlon New Zealand's High Performance Director. We'll talk about things like long-term athlete development, high performance training, and traits of elite triathletes, and how all of those traits are attainable by age group athletes. So we talk a lot about what age groupers can learn from high performance training. And Mark's top three picks for the traits of elite triathletes have nothing to do with genetics, as a little teaser. Thank you again to Precision Hydration for sponsoring this episode. Remember to take their free online sweat test on precisionhydration.com to get your personalized hydration strategy for your next race. And use the discount code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, for 15% off. Thank you, as always, so very much for listening. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you to all of you who have been writing ratings and reviews. Seriously, you always make my day when you do that. It really helps a ton. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.